left the house and went off to a solitary place where he prayed. Simon and his companions went to look for him, and when they found him, they exclaimed, "Everyone is looking for you." Jesus replied, "Let us go somewhere else, to the nearby villages, so I can preach there also. That is why I have come." So he traveled throughout Galilee, preaching in their synagogues and driving out demons. A man with leprosy came to him and begged him on his knees, "If you are willing, you can make me clean." Filled with compassion, Jesus reached out his hand and touched the man. "I am willing," he said, "be clean." Immediately the leprosy left him and he was cured. Jesus sent him away at once with a strong warning. "See that you don't tell this to anyone, but go, show yourself to the priest and offer the sacrifices that Moses commanded for your cleansing as a testimony to them." Instead, he went out and began to talk freely, spreading the news. As a result, Jesus could no longer enter a town openly, but stayed outside in lonely places. Yet the people still came to him from everywhere. The word of the Lord.
There are two kinds of people in the world. There's one kind of person who comes to a job, and these kind of folks, they know just what to do. Okay? They organize. They strategize. They solve the problem. They stick to the long-term goals. They know how to get the job done. These people are wonderful to have around. Okay? You really want these people on your team. We describe them with words like efficient and reliable. And you want them around because they get things done. Great people, wonderful people. But with these kinds of people, there's almost always a besetting fault that comes along. They get the job done, but sometimes at the expense of the needs of the people around them. They tend to lose sight of the point of the plan that they're achieving. Okay? Their living room is so clean that you are afraid to sit down in it. Their schedule is so full of things to do for you that you can't talk to them. Okay? Or maybe they get annoyed with you for interrupting them while they're doing things for you to carry out the plan. Their sin is the tendency to put the plan above the people. But there's the other kind of person. Okay? These people never seem to mind when you interrupt them. They're eminently interruptible. Okay? You get a sense that you're important when you're around them. Okay? They're such wonderful people to have around. You know, we describe them with words like available and warm. You know, and you really want these people on your team because they remind you of the reasons for doing what you're doing. But these folks have a hard time often getting things done. They seem unable to stick to the longer-term goals. They often apply for extensions. They lose the keys. Their living room doesn't get clean, or if it does, only frantically. But their sin is a tendency to put people above the plan. Now, of course, I'm simplifying the world here, but you know, I'm describing, maybe you're along a spectrum, but I'm describing the poles here for a reason. You take my wife and me. By the way, my wife sends her love to you, and my whole family does, actually. They're very anxious to be coming up here, and when we get an apartment, they're going to be joining us, and they're just, they're geared up for it. They want to come and be with you. Someone said to my five-year-old daughter recently, after the weather changed down there, recently someone said to her, "Are you cold?" she said, "No, I'm a New Yorker." I guess there's various ways to interpret that. I'm not just cold, but they're really psyched to come. And but my wife and I, our marriage has really been a 12-year study in what happens when you take two of these people on opposite poles that I just described and put them together to work together, to be married to each other. Now, I'm going to leave it to you to guess which one of us is which. We've changed each other a great deal. I mean, that happens in a marriage. We have changed each other a great deal, but still, we're still on these poles. Supposing, though, that you met one person who had the strengths of both and the weaknesses of neither. What would he look like? As we light our first Advent candle here, and we're approaching the season of the Incarnation, I want to begin to look at Jesus. But today, we're not going to talk about a Christmas story. We're going to look at Jesus in a beginning moment in his ministry that you just heard read. And we're going to do an exegesis of this passage. I'm going to start in the middle. Okay, I'm the preacher. I'm allowed to do that. I'm going to start with verses 40, 41, 42. Okay, we're going to start in the middle, then we're going to look at the beginning, then we're going to look at the end. Because the middle tells us what the real deal is. The middle is the middle. It's the crux. And the middle is about leprosy. Okay? Verse 40. We don't really know. We're not entirely sure what leprosy was back then. But we know that it did make you untouchable. As bad as the disease was, what was worse is that you lost your friends. It made you the discarded of the society. And nobody wanted you anymore. Nobody wanted to be near you. And nobody certainly would touch you. You lost human contact. Nobody would touch you. I talk with an acquaintance of mine, Dr. Frank Young, who is the former head of the FDA. And very interesting, because one time he said to me that he thought that AIDS was the modern equivalent of leprosy. And that's significant coming from him, because AIDS really became an issue during his administration. And you think about it, there's a lot to recommend that view. This was a disease that was seemingly incurable. It had a stigma attached to it. And it ended up, you know, that was the end of human contact in a lot of cases for you. Okay, so there's a lot to that parallel. That's why we are so blessed and so support the Isaiah 58 ministry in this church, because it's really doing what Jesus was doing right here. It was touching folks that have a stigma of being untouchable. And verse 41 tells us that Jesus was moved with compassion. I love this word, splagnesomai. Because it's one of the few places in the gospel where the gospel writer describes Jesus' motivation behind his action, right? We get a lot of things where gospel is telling us what Jesus did. Very few places where they go behind and say, this is why he did what he did. But here's a place where they do. He's moved with compassion. And so what Mark is doing, you see, is he's inviting us into the realm of Jesus' psychology in a way. And it's also one of these places where we get a clue about how different Jesus is from me. Because I know in my heart that when I see somebody greatly suffering or with a big problem, my inclination is to run the other way. You know, I tend to recoil from great suffering. And I learned this about myself by riding the New York City subway. Because you know, those of you who ride the subway know that around any corner, you may be faced with some of the city's great suffering. There's serious suffering going on in this city, and it might be around any corner in the subway. And my inclination, when I come to face to face with a person like that, is to, I'm not towards them, I want to recoil. Hey, God is not like that. God is not like that. See, the chorus of the Old Testament is that the Lord is gracious and merciful, slow to anger, and abounding in loving kindness or steadfast love. And it's always been interesting to me that you can find that whole expression there in all parts of the Old Testament. This is a chorus that spans, 2,000 years of sacred writing. And in all the different literary genres of the Old Testament, it's in the law, it's in early narrative, it's in the late narrative, it's in the writings. In one of the Psalms, you can find this. Why does it keep cropping up? Well, it's because it's so true. God is merciful. He is motivated by mercy. He is kind. That's why. So when you see in verse 41, the way it's written is very deliberate. Jesus reached out, says the gospel writer, and he touched him. It's very deliberately written. Because that was just not something that you did. You did not touch a leper. And motivated by his compassion, Jesus reached out and he touched him. It was an astonishing thing to do. So you see the gospel writer's surprise at this. Now this is something, I'm bringing this out because it's something that you need to know. When you're in need, if you're in need this morning, especially in great need, God's heart is towards you. Okay? Yahweh is near to the brokenhearted. He saves the crushed in spirit. What Jesus is showing us here is the very heart of God toward great need. Now, if we move to verse 43, verse 44, what we see is an amazing change here. It's the way it was translated, with the NIV this morning, that he gave him a strict charge. That is actually with a strong warning. It isn't a prepositional phrase. In the Greek, it's a verb. It's a very strong word. It's embrimaomai is the verb. And it's a word expressing great intensity. It's not much used in the New Testament. It's not much used outside of the New Testament. So it's a word the gospel writer deliberately chose here. Expresses great emotion and intensity. That's what it's reserved for. And I wanted to go into the meaning of this word a little bit for a little while here, just to bring this out because it's key. After Jesus is motivated by compassion, he turns around and he does what this word is. What is this word? Well, Mark uses it once more at the end of the gospel. He uses it for this intense yelling at a woman that people did when she came in and anointed Jesus' head with expensive oil, and they were indignant. And they embrimaomai her. Okay, they yelled intensely at her. The gospel writer John uses it. He uses it when Jesus comes to the tomb of the friend that just died. His friend, a close friend of his, died. He came to the tomb, and I think it might be translated there, he was grieved in spirit or something. But it's the same word. It's embrimaomai. It's some intense, intense expression of emotion there. At the tomb. Go back into the Septuagint, which is the Greek translation of the Old Testament. We find this word used in Lamentations, which is a story about Israel at its low point after God sends Israel into exile. And I would like to read to you how this word is used. Lamentations 2:6. It's talking about God, what God did to Israel. God has broken down his booth like that of a garden, laid in ruins the place of his appointed feast. The Lord has brought it to an end in Zion, appointed feast and Sabbath. And in his, here used as a noun, in his fierce indignation, he has spurned king and priest. Okay, very intense word. In fact, and always negative, you notice. Now, it's used one place we can find outside of these scriptures in Greek literature, and I thought it would be fun to bring this in, actually read you a passage where it appears. It's in the Greek, it's used by the Greek poet Aeschylus, you might remember is one of those Greek poets, Greek playwrights, one of the first to write a play with more than just the one character in the chorus. And he wrote a number of plays, and this is from his play, Seven Against Thebes. What I'm going to do is I'm going to read the passage. I want you to try to figure out want you to try to guess where Embrimaoma is being used. Okay? This is about this battle against Thebes, and the horses and the army are chomping at the bit. They're ready to go to attack. They're ready to go. This is the passage. See where it's used. Okay. Soldier. Now for the next to draw the gate he should attack. The third lot leaping from the upturned bronze helmet sent Eteocles to hurl his troops against the Nystian gate. His restless mares, eager to charge the entrance, toss their frontlets as he turns them now this way, now that, their muzzle pipes filled with the proud beast's breath, and snortings sound out a savage music. On his shield is a device, no humble one, a man in armor climbing up by a ladder to the enemy's wall to sack their town. And this man too shouts, his words are written there, Ares himself shall not repulse me from their walls. It's a beautiful passage. Where do you think that verb was used? Well, I won't ask you to raise your hands, but I'll tell you, see if you're right. It was for the horses when they snorted. Okay, it was the snorting of the horses. That's the same word being used there. Okay, I don't mean to say that Jesus snorted at this man. But I wanted to give you a sense of the semantic range of this word to show you that it was intense what he did. Now, you might be able to soften it a little. Say, well, you know, yelled, strong warning. You might be able to soften it somewhat. But you can't soften it that much. And you certainly can't soften what he does next, which is he throws the guy out. Actually casts him out. Ekbalo, actually, same word used when Jesus casts out a demon. He throws him out of the place. Okay, so what is Jesus doing? And his charge, you know, is very emphatic. Say nothing to nobody, literally in the Greek. Double negative. Nothing. Don't say nothing to nobody. Is Jesus just capricious? You know? How could he be so compassionate and then so vehement? You know, if I were a disciple, I think that there would be many moments like this where I'd be looking kind of back and forth, completely befuddled. And then maybe a long time later, maybe years later, suddenly realizing, wow, so that's what was going on. I never realized someone could be that good, that loving. Truly, God is love. I think that would be many moments for me like that as a disciple. Folks, I'm going to say to you, the reason that he yelled at the leper and cast him out, threw him out, the till recently leper, was to prevent the crowds. See, let's go back to verse 36 through 39. It sets it up for us. Okay, it sets up the reasons. The disciples are looking for Jesus high and low, and they're really looking for him. The verb tells us that, you know, they were worried. Okay, they weren't just out for a jaunt in the morning. They were searching for him high and low, trying to find him. And verse 37, when they find him, you know, they don't say, you know, how are you? We missed you. What's up? You know, it's what's on their mind is everybody's looking for you. You know the iron is hot, Jesus, because of what you did. You know, everybody's seeking you. You can tell they're being crowd driven. These disciples, they're being people driven. You know, the audience is growing. The iron is hot, Jesus. Let's keep striking. Let's do it right. And Jesus' answer is very odd in verse 38. And I loved how Ty read it there, very matter of fact. You know, they're saying, everybody's looking for you. Jesus says, well, let's go somewhere else. You see that? Let's go somewhere else. Let's go into these other towns. But it's because of his ministry plan, which he tells them. That's why he wants to do this. And he lays out the plan. For this reason I came out. You know, do you want to know what Jesus' long-term project is? Here it is. He wants to get into as many population centers of this region of Galilee as possible to preach. Okay, that's his plan, to get into the towns. Okay? And verse 39 tells us that he was doing that. He was following that plan and actually doing it. That was his plan, get into as many population centers as he could so people could hear him preach. Now, people also, Jesus knew something about people. He knew that people are desperate. He knew that humanity is full of needs, that we're sold under sin, sickness racks our bodies. You know, many people, many, many people are just desperate for hope. Jesus knew that. I mean, that much we can identify with. That hasn't changed much through time just because now we have vacuum cleaners. Okay? And he certainly wanted to minister to those needs, yes. But he wanted his message to reach even the people who were not desperate. Oh, the desperate would come, for sure. But what about the others? What about the people who needed his gospel just as much, who still needed forgiveness and needed to be shown that they needed forgiveness, who were just as bad off as the leper, but not so aware of it? Well, where were they? In the towns. And Jesus knew that if word got out that he healed a leper, you know, not just cast out a demon, not just healed other diseases, but healed a leper, he'd be swamped. And if that happened, he couldn't take his preaching into those population centers anymore, into the business lives of the people while they were doing their work. You know, he couldn't go and preach in the marketplaces. And a certain type of people would never hear his preaching again in person. So out of his love for the non-desperate, he wanted that ministry to go on as long as possible. I mean, just imagine, supposing that, you know, 6 o'clock news tonight, you sit down, and it's announced that there's an instant cure for AIDS. Cure. Not just 3 drugs that put it off, but cure. Okay, instant. Or maybe cancer, too. Cancer and or AIDS. Cancer and AIDS. Okay. Put together. All right, comes across on the 6 o'clock news tonight. And, you know, cancer and AIDS, that implies probably any other disease, right? You know? Or maybe. It's also the newscaster tells you it's completely free. No medical insurance needed. All you had to do was show up, apparently. It's available in one man, only in one place, perhaps only one day. Supposing that comes across on the news. Now, what do you think the traffic pattern would be like Monday morning along West Side Drive? What do you think it would be like in the Holland Tunnel? What would it be like at LaGuardia? Folks, there were about 1 or 2 million people in Palestine at that time. And if you wonder what would happen, this news gets out. Well, you don't really have to wonder. If you have your Bibles, you can turn right back to verse 28 and see what happened after Jesus just did one exorcism. What happened? Gospel writers saying, oh, he's people coming from all over that region of Galilee. Or you could look forward, as we're going to do now, to what actually did happen in verse 45. See, the guy goes out, and you can see Mark's point here. He's making clear the lepers, the till recently lepers, disobedience. He says he talked freely, spread the news, directly disobeys Jesus' word, directly. Okay? And, you know, this is another proof that the Gospels are true. They're not just made-up stories. It's the kind of good thing to question that you might bring up at a Q&A, like we do here after the service. But it shows us here, just the way this is written, it's one of the reasons you can believe that it's true. Because this is just what would happen in real life if a miracle happened to ordinary folk like you and me. Okay? We have this idea sometimes that these people involved in these miracles were walking around with their feet 3 feet off the ground. You know, that suddenly, you know, something good happens and they stop sinning, they stop doing anything wrong. Not so. They remain sinners just as we do when God does great things for us, right? Do we not? Do we get suddenly holier and better behaved when God does something great for us? Often not. Often not. Often it's the opposite. So before you look down at the leper in your heart, ask yourself how you would have done. Have you ever even tried to not talk about something life-changing that you were excited about for the sake of another? You ever even tried that? You know, he walked down the street, met somebody. Somebody said, hey, say, didn't you used to be a leper? Yes, I used to be a leper. No one would come near me. Nobody would touch me. My life was in shambles. And Jesus touched me. And blah, 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 off he went all over Galilee. And the result is, and it's telling that Mark ends this passage, ends the pericope with this word in the Greek, pantothen. He actually ends the whole passage with this word. People are coming to him from all quarters, literally in every direction. Jesus looked north, people were coming. He looked south, people are coming. East, west, coming from every direction. He couldn't budge. And, you know, going on in chapter 2, when he finally gets to Capernaum, you know, people find out he's at Peter's house. There's so many crowds that people are just cutting through the roof to try to get to him. So in other words, by the end of the passage, people, because of the healed leper, Jesus' time of preaching in the towns was over, at least in that region of Galilee. And the rest of this half of the book pictures him as managing his ministry around the crowds. It's crowd management from this point on. Now listen, folks. When he met the leper, he knew that. He knew that possibility was right there in front of him. He knew it when the man fell to his knees in front of him. And what's perhaps the most amazing thing about this passage is that Jesus, knowing the risk, knowing the whole plan that he had, healed him anyway. He healed him anyway. Note two things. First, God's heart is being shown here. In spite of our misuse of his gifts, in spite of our disobedience, God wishes to do us good anyway, even if he knows it's going to happen. And that's what we see in Jesus. This is what God is like. It's what he's like. He will heal you and help you knowing that you may disobey him. He will die for you on a cross even while you're hating him. And secondly, I want you to see that it's because of his love for all types of people that Jesus, following his compassionate healing, so harshly treated this man in a deliberate way to impress upon him as strongly as he could to keep quiet. See, the compassion and then the vehemence shows us God's perfect character. You know those two types of people in the world with their accompanying strengths and weaknesses? You got people whose lives are in control tend to put the plan above the people. You have people who are tender tend to put the people above the plan. Jesus held them both together perfectly. And then, after he did what he could, he entrusted himself to the Father. See, Jesus is not a control freak. He does not withhold the healing because this guy has the potential to mess up his crucial ministry plan. He stops short of letting his concern about being thronged too early prevent someone in need from receiving his help. He allows his compassion to make the decision to give this guy help. He didn't have to. He risked it, knowing that it was the better path to take. And then Jesus did all that he could to prevent the news from spreading, and then he entrusted the outcome to his Father. Do you see this beauty in Jesus? This is the one that you're dealing with in your life right now. Why the struggle? Why are you fighting him? Why? What is there to fight here? Why all this struggling to look for loopholes out of Christianity or out of his will for you that you know? I mean, isn't this the kind of person you always wanted to know? Somebody who can get things done, but who is sensitive to the people he's with? Well, here he is. Here he is, desirous of being your closest friend. I mean, isn't this the kind of person you always wanted to work for? You know, a boss who wasn't a control freak? Well, listen, here is one you can serve, who you can really believe in as your Lord, Isn't this the kind of person you've always wanted to elect? A kinder, gentler ruler, yet with a backbone for the long-term plan, for the long-term goal. Well, folks, he is king already, even without your vote. But you can elect him so in your heart. Why do you fight him? Imagine the leper and how Jesus looked at him, wanting to heal him in spite of his faults. That's how he looks at you. That's how he looks at me. Turn to him now as we pray.